This is Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, happy holidays. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Of course, Thanksgiving is tomorrow. Time to be thankful for friends and family, good health. But it's also a day infamous for its messiness. You know what I'm talking about. Family drama, politics, those burnt side dishes you wish you could forget. Well, in the spirit of the holiday season, we ask you to share your most unforgettable holiday stories with KCRW. And today, on Greater LA, we're sharing three of them. We start off with Isabel Havens. She recalls the first time her now brother-in-law joined her family for the first time for Thanksgiving.
My older sister decided to bring her boyfriend, now husband, along to spend Thanksgiving with the whole family. And as a little sister, I was super excited for him to join us. My dad decided this year that he was going to bake a pumpkin pie for everyone. And my dad has a super long list of amazing skills and talents. I don't know if I would put baking at the top of that list. Sorry, Dad. But he decided he was going to bake a pumpkin pie for us. So on the day of Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law's there. Everyone's getting along. But I can tell my brother-in-law really wants to spend more time with my dad. He was still trying to get into his good graces. Dessert comes around and the pumpkin pie comes out. We're all super excited. We each get a big slice. My dad's really proud of what he made. It did look really good. We all go to take our first bite and my dad forgot to put sugar in it. I don't know if you've had pumpkin puree without any sweetener, but it's definitely not the most appetizing. So me and all my siblings proceed to just start roasting my dad for screwing up the pumpkin pie, completely making fun of him for it. In the middle of us, you know, sort of complaining about the ruined dessert, I look over and my dear, kind brother-in-law is eating every single bite of his pumpkin pie and even complimenting my dad on how good it tastes. The rest of us definitely didn't agree, but it was very sweet of him to be so kind and to make my dad feel good about his pumpkin pie. I think they were the only two that ate it that year. And this is my favorite story about the holidays, so much so that on my sister and my brother-in-law's wedding day, I included it in my speech in front of everyone, just to make fun of and embarrass him a little bit. But I think it really shows a lot about the holiday season.
Well, there was this time. It was the mid-90s, and I was in college and had returned to my hometown in rural Southern Illinois. On Christmas Eve, I ended up hanging out with a new friend. Even though we had both grown up in the same small town, we had only recently been introduced. There might have been a little bit of a vibe between us. We ended up at my mom's house, just sitting there drinking cheap wine out of plastic cups and listening to the Elvis Presley Christmas album while she made coleslaw in the kitchen for our family get-together the next day. And it probably got to be around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. My mom was going to bed. He and I were both a little riled up, but it was 2 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Eve. And so we decided that we would drive around and look at Christmas lights. The center of town literally had a town square with the old style courthouse in the middle and about a dozen or so of those wire light up deer figures on the lawn. We parked, we jumped out of the car, we ran across the lawn, grabbed one of the deer and stowed it in the back of his trunk. And we were laughing and giggling, and at that point, we were both getting very hungry and a little bit tired, but there was not going to be any place open at that time. So we drove a few blocks, took a right, and lo and behold, there was this yellow light spilling from these windows of this tiny cafe, which really blew my mind because I had lived in that town my entire childhood and never once set foot in that tiny cafe. So we had eggs and bacon and biscuits, and we sat there in silence, enjoying the moment. We left the waitress a generous tip, and then we got in his car, and as we drove through the center of town, we pulled the car over, We got the light-up deer out of the back of his trunk, and we returned it to its proper place on the lawn. We just did it. And then he drove me back to my house and dropped me off. And that was the first time that I ever hung out with him. And we're still friends almost 30 years later.
Let me set this scene. It's 2010, the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. I'm 22 and in the throes of midterm projects. I have a missed call from an unlisted number and a new voicemail message. As an elder millennial, I wonder who even leaves voicemails anymore. With a sigh and much eye rolling, I press play.
Katie, this is your uncle. I need you to call me when I get this message.
Cue adrenaline. For the past couple years, he's been living in the valley as my grandfather's primary caretaker. By his tone of voice, something is seriously wrong. My imagination and anxiety are now running wild. I assume that Grandpa has to be in the hospital or dead. I can't find any of the phone numbers I need. So I give in and I call my mother. I just got this really weird voicemail from my uncle. This is what I think it is. My mother takes a deep breath and in one go says,
"Well, if you thought that I've been having an affair and your father found out and just kicked me out of the house, then yes, it is exactly what you think it is."
We're going to take a moment of stunned silence. Because this is a lot of new information. Oh, okay. Then Grandpa's all right?
Yes, honey. As far as I know, your grandfather is just fine.
I don't really remember that follow-up phone call, or truthfully, most of the numerous conversations in those subsequent days with either of my parents. For some inexplicable reason, my father, his brother, and my grandfather, who was, again, in fact, perfectly fine and not dead, decided that they were all still going to travel up the Central Coast to my mom's brother's house, where my mother, who he was still refusing to let back into our childhood home, and her parents would also be celebrating Thanksgiving. I've been told by those who suffered through the evening that the tensions were palpable. I was tickled when I found out a couple of years ago that my mom now refers to that Tuesday before Thanksgiving as Fan Day, as in the shit hit the fan, which makes this our 12th fanniversary since all of those infamous proceedings.
That was Isabel Havens, Tiffany Root, and Katie Shanks. Thank you to all three for sharing your stories. This piece was produced by KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo. The original score and sound design by John Meek. And speaking of stories, we're still collecting submissions for some of your unforgettable holiday stories. You know, Thanksgiving is just the beginning of it before, of course, Hanukkah and Christmas and the rest of them. Before New Year's, we're collecting them into December. So if you've got a memory that you just can't shake, submit it to kcrw.com/holiday. Well, coming up, meet the art forger who could draw and paint like the best of them, except he wasn't them and made a lot of money that way until, well, you're going to have to hear that story, which is on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. When it comes to art, beauty, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. But in the multi-billion-dollar art market, value is determined by more than just the quality of the work. The artist's name recognition and the piece's provenance, its origin and history, also matter a lot. Picasso, Rembrandt, Monet, Da Vinci, their signatures fetch high prices for sure. So what happens when what was thought to be a genuine masterpiece turns out to be a fake? L.A. artist Tony Tetro spent decades making highly sophisticated forgeries that wound up in galleries and collections all around the world. After living the high life with expensive cars and vacations, he got busted and went to jail. But now he has a story to tell about his life as both con man and artist. And Tony is with us along with his co-author, journalist Giampiero Ambrosi. Welcome to you both.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to be with you today. Tony, in the opening of your book, this caught me. You write that the French painter Camille Corot painted 3,000 canvases, 10,000 of which have been sold in America. How is it possible for that much rampant forgery to go on unchecked, or has it been checked?
That's an old story, and I've heard that the number, he did 5,000 paintings in his lifetime, and 10,000 are in the United States. This has been going on for 50 years, that statement, talking about how much forgery there is in the art market.
And the forgeries, of course, thanks to the forgers, but also to the galleries that, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, took some of these and paid for some of these forgeries, right?
I think one thing that's really interesting about the dealers is that Tony never really sold his works. You always think of the forger kind of duping the client. But in this case, the client was the dealer, and the dealer would commission him to do it. And he'd just say, hey, I need 50 Picassos. Give me 50. Somebody would call him up. Give me 20 Miros. I need 10 Dalis. So it wasn't that he was duping anybody, really. The dealers were just commissioning him.
Well, at first, yeah. I did. I would. Shorts and flip-flops on. I go to galleries. And then the word got out about me. And this one man named Bernie, I'll just say his name, he's from Brooklyn or the Bronx, he had a thick accent. And he went around, he bought everything from me, Chagall, Miro, Dali, Picasso, everything. And then he found out that I did them. And he was like hurt or upset or, anyway, he sold everything. So he didn't do anything about it legally. But he went around telling everybody, every art dealer that he knew or could find, and he'd tell them about me. And what they did, in fact, was get in touch with me.
That was like Tony's best advertising, is this guy who was really mad because he got duped, went around and said, watch out for Tetro, he's a faker.
Yeah.
And that was his advertising.
So let's rewind even further than that and go back to when you started doing this, right? You were always artistic and you loved to draw. What made you focus on this?
I read a book is the reason I focused on this. I read a book called Fake by Clifford Irving. There was an art forger that was his friend, and he wrote a book called Fake about Almir Dahori. So when I read that book, it's really the beginning of this for me. The more I read, the more I said to myself, I could do this.
And by the way, we have a clip from Clifford Irving about Almir Dahori. This is from Orson Welles' movie called F for Fake. And this is Clifford Irving talking about what you might call the art forger's ethos. Let's listen.
The important distinction to make when you're talking about the genuine quality of a painting is not so much whether it's a real painting or a fake. It's whether it's a good fake or a bad fake.
That's Clifford Irving in Orson Welles' F for Fake. Do you agree with that sentiment, by the way? I mean, what did you learn from Almir, the famous Hungarian art forger?
So one thing that Tony told me about Almir Dahori was that it was just the kind of the guts to go and do a fake and to say, oh, yeah, you know, I was friends with Modigliani, so he made this
provenance.
For me.
He didn't have to have provenance. Let's say it was a Picasso, a mon ami, Almir Dahori, to my friend, Almir Dahori. And he did that a lot. And today, provenance is more important than the work of art itself.
How'd you eventually get busted?
a Yamagata, Hiro Yamagata. And Yamagata's had his family visiting from Japan. And they walked by this gallery and they go, there's your paintings. And he goes, I didn't do those. That's how I got caught.
What have you been doing since, Tony?
Painting. I've been doing a lot of Caravaggio lately. I like old masters.
And what do you do with those paintings as opposed to what you used to do with those paintings?
Sell them. I'm commissioned. Just because somebody's rich doesn't mean they don't want to save money. So I have a lot of people who are wealthy and could afford the original, but they buy them for me instead. I do a painting that never existed in the style of Chagall, Picasso. I've got just did two Caravaggios. I love to do Caravaggio.
Yeah, that's an important point. You know, a lot of people think that Tony would copy paintings. He didn't actually copy paintings. He made forgeries in the style of...
Right,
or
a Chagall that never existed, a Picasso that never existed.
Giampiero, you reported on this for the Daily Mail. Can you explain what happened with some of those paintings and how it actually involves Prince Charles, now King Charles?
Sure. So Tony made some reproductions for a purported billionaire, and Tony went to visit him in London. And when he was there, he was alone quite a lot of the time because the other guy would sleep all day. And when he's there, Tony saw some papers. And on those papers, they appeared to be loan documents or something, some kind of legal document. And it had pictures of Tony's reproductions for this guy. So, you know, scared, they're worried that something fishy was going on. He took some pictures and he showed them to me. And so that started off an investigation that took 3 years. And what we discovered, including doing some undercover work and, you know, kind of going far and wide across the UK and the US, was that this person, James Stunt, had put these Tony Tetro fakes into the collection of Prince, now King Charles, and then had turned around and used those paintings as collateral to get an enormous loan. This was all, you know, this was all unknown to Tony, but if you kind of put this fake collection together, you claim it's worth $300 million, and then you go to a lender and you say, lend me $150 million. Now, even if you keep the money, the lender keeps the collateral, which isn't worth even a tenth of what they say it's worth. You've made a pretty good day's work right there.
When I saw the papers, I was worried immediately because of this provenance. I said, that's not good. This will never work. And so I took the photos because I said, oh, I got to have some evidence. If I didn't take those photos, I'd probably be in a British prison right now.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you both. Wow, what a harrowing and colorful tale. Thanks to you both for coming on. Tony Tetro, famous art forger, the new tell-all memoir is called Con Artist, The Life and Crimes of the World's Greatest Art Forger, and his co-author, Giampiero Ambrosi. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. And before you leave us today, a Thanksgiving treat. Every year, KCRW challenges storytellers and radio enthusiasts to create a great audio story, and they have just 24 hours to do it. Hundreds of producers from around the world participate, and we promise to put the best pieces on the air, right? Well, it's called the Radio Race, and this year the theme was, Can You Keep a Secret? The winner for the best LA-based story was a team of Angel Carreras and Nisha Venkat. The two of them actually met through KCRW, where Angel was once a reporting fellow and Nisha a USC luminary fellow. And together they call themselves Toe Beans, and the name of their story is Heaven by the Highway. Here it is.
Uno, dos, tres.
L.A., it's a big place. You've crisscrossed it in a car, truck, one of those weird three-wheeled things. I don't know. It's fast-paced. Point A, point B, a lot of freeway, in between, the hustle, the bustle. Eek! But L.A. is also a place that'll reward you for slowing down, finding its secret sanctuaries, like this little slice of heaven right next to the 110. To reach this holy land, you must make a pilgrimage on foot. push past those pearly gates, then feast your eyes on paradise.
I never knew this existed. I thought maybe it was a school. Like, I had no clue. I never really peeked up over the fence. So when I walked in, I was like, what the f*** is this oasis situation?
The hillside rises gently, and in the distance you see stoneworks reminiscent of Incan terraces and, you know, trees thick with fruit and foliage.
Michelangelo himself couldn't have carved this out of the earth. It's...
I have some Thai red chilies, arugula, more green onion, and my jalapeno. And this beautiful...
Okay, fine. It's a community garden. But it's not just a community garden. It's the city's best kept secret. So well kept, in fact, that we cannot tell you where it is.
Because you get, like, influencers wanting to come here and, like, do pictures, and it's like, man, just
garden,
you know?
TikTok popping up.
Oh. But it's not my garden either. It was here before me, and it belongs to everybody.
They right? do mean everybody. People from Pasadena to Echo Park to East LA. They're all hoeing hoes, weeding weeds.
Este se llama machete. Machete para cortar.
And after a long day, they all settle down for lunch. Here's what that crowd looked like seated on a bench Saturday afternoon. A blue-haired liberal next to an old Mexican lady offering beans, rice, and a freshly plucked jalapeno to a cool, tatted-up guy. It's an L.A. Last Supper.
What was your name?
My name is Hortensia.
Hortensia?
Mm-hmm. Can you give me another plate, please?
Did you want some as well?
Sure. Yeah.
When was the last time you made a friend that was so different from you? When was the last time you went to a place that would allow you to do that?
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. Have a nice day. You're welcome.
And it's not only the food or the company that's nourishing. It's just the act of being here at the garden. It's a welcome break from where we are most of the time, staring at a screen.
I found it during the pandemic, actually, because I was going to USC, and then we went completely online. And, like, the week we went completely online, I was like, well, what am I supposed to do now? And then I was like, I want a garden.
I work digitally a lot. And so to be able to get my hands dirty in the soil is really important to me, to stay connected to the earth, because humans and nature, we really lean on each other.
This is a community Garden of Eden. So why aren't there lines out the door like, I don't know, like there were when Egg Sled opened?
I've been here for 3 years and I've seen so many people come through here to visit this place who are drawn in and fascinated by it. And yet ultimately, the people that stick around, there's not that many. This place has been around here for like 20, 30 years. And people drive under it every single day. And I meet people all the time. I say, oh, I'm at some garden. Oh, where is that? Oh, it's over by people who've lived in LA their entire lives have no idea that it's here. And so there has to be something kind of like a force or something like that that sort of keeps this place a little bit under the radar. I trust in the energy of the garden to keep it a little bit safe.
This piece was produced by Team Toe Beans as part of KCRW's 24-hour radio race.
That's going to do it for us today. We are eating our way through Thanksgiving. We'll be back plump and juicy on Monday. Next week, the heat is on to get solar panels above the LA Aqueduct. But why? Check us out online at kcrw.com/GLA. There you can tell us what's on your mind. Share a story idea with us. Who's making magic in greater LA, or maybe not so magic? And of course, subscribe to the podcast too while you're there. kcrw.com/GLA. Or of course, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and your ears. Happy Thanksgiving, and have a great night.